Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS, FM, and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Have you ever driven down the highway and seen one of those signs, those adopt-a-highway signs? This mile of highway adopted by your friendly neighborhood Rotary Club, this mile adopted by Boy Scout Troop 125. I'm sure you have seen them if you've been paying any attention at all. Maybe you've even seen the groups in question dressed in their careful vests, their orange vests along the side of the road, picking up trash, actually making the highway more beautiful, exercising the duties that they agreed to perform in exchange for that nice sign along the highway. What if you were driving along today and you saw a sign that said, "This mile of highway adopted by your friendly neighborhood Ku Klux Klan"? And what if you happened upon the Klan branch when it was out for its annual or semi-annual cleanup day and you didn't see guys in orange vests? You saw a bunch of guys maybe wearing hoods and sheets and all the rest of it. It's rather, well, sort of a comical, but still also sort of a disturbing image, isn't it? But of course, nothing like that could ever happen, could it? Well, it has. It's happened in more than one place, or at least it's trying to happen in more than one place. Most recently, as far as I know, in the state of Georgia. I read about an application by the local chapter of the Ku Klux Klan in North Georgia, an application to adopt a highway that was refused by the state on some very shaky constitutional grounds, or I should say, in a way that arguably violates the Constitution, and specifically the First Amendment of the Constitution, because when it denied the Klan's Adopt-a-Highway request, the state of Georgia cited, among other things, the very disturbing political viewpoints of the Ku Klux Klan. Now, most of us would agree that the Klan's political viewpoint is fairly disturbing, but on the other hand, does the state of Georgia, or any state, have any business deciding which political viewpoints are acceptable and which are not? Well, as you might guess, the ACLU doesn't think so, and the ACLU in Georgia has agreed to represent the Ku Klux Klan in its quest. And I had the great pleasure recently of traveling down to Atlanta and speaking to representatives of the ACLU. Let's start with my conversation with Debbie Seagraves, the director of the Atlanta branch of the American Civil Liberties Union.
The ACLU of Georgia is the statewide affiliate for the American Civil Liberties Union, which is the largest public interest law organization in the country. We argue more cases before the United States Supreme Court than any other organization, aside from the Justice Department, of course, and that's all they do.
Well, I guess they would have the number one slot, wouldn't they? Tremendous. And so you're the affiliate here in Georgia.
Correct. We have been operating here for, well, actually 50 years next year.
Congratulations.
And we have a long history of not just litigation, but community organizing, public education, and work at our Georgia General Assembly.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we start with the basics? What is the purpose of the ACLU? I've spoken with Ira Glasser, your former executive director, and so I'm familiar with your organization, but I just always like to let people tell me in their own words what their reason for existence is. And
well, the ACLU is an organization that's set up to protect and defend the Constitution. And we have, I would say, a special concentration on the First Amendment, but certainly not to the exclusion of other work. We are known throughout history, not just in Georgia, but nationwide, for the defense of unpopular causes and for unpopular speech. And I tend to tell folks everywhere I go, it's only unpopular speech that needs protection. So those are the cases you hear about.
One word, Skokie.
Illinois, Skokie, Illinois.
That's when I first became aware of what the ACLU does. The famous or infamous case, if you prefer, when the ACLU got together with a very strange bedfellow, the American Nazi Party, I believe it was, and defended their right to march through Skokie.
It was a part of the American Nazi Party. It was actually, I'll tell you the full name of the group here in a minute, but it was like the American Socialist something. Anyway, I should know it by heart. You would think that after all of the hullabaloo around Skokie, I'll mention some details of it, that people would recognize that free speech is almost an absolute. Free speech is almost an absolute. Should be almost an absolute. There are some exceptions. You can't famously falsely yell fire in a crowded theater.
Right.
You can't legally incite to riot, but then again, a lot of that is perception and interpretation. Mm-hmm. But we should know by now that one of the founding principles of this government, of this country, is that you get to say the thing that other people disagree with without fear of being prosecuted by the government. And you would think after all these years that there would be more understanding of what free speech means. For instance, free speech doesn't mean you get to say anything you want to say without criticism. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that your neighbors can't get angry at you, and it doesn't mean that somebody else won't tell you to sit down and shut up.
That happens to me frequently.
And, you know, people who are running for office, sometimes I hear them say, I've actually heard Sarah Palin say this a lot. Well, everybody finds fault with what I say. Don't I have freedom of speech? Absolutely. And do we have freedom of speech to criticize you? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But the government can't shut you down. That's the issue here. The government can't shut you down. They can neither put you in jail for saying something they don't like. They can't deny you equal treatment because your opinion is different. They can't discriminate against you because your viewpoint is not one that's shared by elected officials. And they can't shut you down or forbid you to speak or exercise something called prior restraint, meaning shut you up before you talk, because there is a fear that someone else will act badly. Hmm. So that's called a heckler's veto. Mm-hmm. You can't say, no, you have a right to speak, but we're not going to give you a permit because other people might get violent against you if you say that. That's a heckler's veto. The government can't use that as an excuse for shutting you down, forbidding you to speak, or to punish you for speaking.
Well, now, Debbie, that was a marvelous little mini lesson on free speech, and you tell me yet that you're not an attorney? So where did you pick all this stuff up?
I often tell people I'm not an attorney, but I play one on TV. Well, you know, I mean, here's the thing. I think there is really a problem in that more citizens don't believe that everyone should know that. They think that's something that lawyers know. When I was in high school, we still had civics. Mm-hmm. And we used to teach this to kids in high school. So, you know, I don't find it unusual that I would know this. I don't find it unusual that you, of course, as a law professor, would know it. What I find amazing is that we have people running for high office in our land, and they don't know it. And that we have people at our legislature making laws, and they don't know it. That's scary to me. That's frightening to me. And every year at the Georgia legislature, there are laws that are passed or laws that are considered and defeated that make it clear to me that the concept of free speech is simply not understood or not accepted. There are many elements to the First Amendment. Speech is only one of them. Mm-hmm. I think the First Amendment is clearly misunderstood by many, many lawmakers.
Well, Debbie, that is why we have this radio show.
Yay.
Part of the reason we have this radio show is so that even if they're not teaching it in high school, by golly, we're going to talk about it. Most of our listeners are not lawyers, and that's fine. You're right. American citizens, indeed people all over the world, need to understand these concepts, and I'm very glad that we can talk about them. And so I mean no disrespect. In fact, I have great respect for you as a non-lawyer who has all this knowledge about the First Amendment. But now, of course, the reason we're here today is to discuss yet another circumstance where the ACLU seems to have associated itself with some not very nice people who are saying some not very nice things, and now who want to do something relatively unusual. So I'm going to let you tell us all about it.
Okay, and let me back up, because I don't want to start out the conversation saying that our clients are not nice people.
Okay.
And or that they are saying things that are not nice.
Uh-huh.
Since Skokie, and we, maybe I should do just a little bit about Skokie.
You tell the story your way, Debbie.
So basically, back in 1970, I think it was 1976. I could be.
You're in the ballpark.
Yeah, it's about 1976.
77, not yet.
There was a group affiliated with the American Nazi Party, and they had applied for a permit to march. Actually, I believe in Chicago, and were turned down. And in order to make a big splash, they applied for the same permit in Skokie, Illinois, which was a town that had a high population of Holocaust survivors.
Right. Heavily Jewish population.
Heavily Jewish population and a high number of actual Holocaust survivors, people who had been in camps. It could be argued that the group applied for the permit there because that is the place where it would get the most attention. The city council or the village council, I don't remember for sure what it was called, turned down the permit request. Now, to be clear, they weren't applying to march through town. They were applying to march around and around in a circle in a certain place in town. They went to the ACLU, the American Nazi Party, when they were turned down for the permit, and the ACLU agreed to represent them in their application process. Which actually meant that you had to bring a lawsuit against the city for failing to grant a permit. So what a lot of folks don't know about that, and the ACLU won that case. It's very important to say this does not in any way mean that the ACLU agreed with the principles of the plaintiff. It does not in any way mean that they supported the cause.
Okay, so it doesn't mean the ACLU is just a bunch of Nazis.
No.
Okay,
as a matter of fact, the attorney that represented them was a Jewish man.
Mm-hmm.
And it was clear to him that there was a principle involved here that was very important. And think about what was going on in history at the time. In the 70s, we were still having demonstrations in the South. We had just come out of a decade where... when people of color got together in March, they were hosed and the dogs were set on them.
Yeah, that had only been about 10 years earlier. The marches, the famous march in Selma had been in the late 50s. We'd had, of course, the famous marches and gatherings in front of the Lincoln Memorial with Dr. King.
Right.
So it was relatively in relatively recent memory that we had the images, of course, of the attack dogs being sicked upon the civil rights marchers. We
right.
had, of course, a number of women's liberation marches, as they used to be called. This was
right.
the era of the ERA, and beyond that, we'd even had a few gay rights riots in the early 1970s. So these sorts of things,
Stonewall.
The Stonewall riot had happened when, like 1969 or 70. And so, I mean, these were the sorts of things that were going on fairly frequently, and violence was not that uncommon, and the government was not always very, very friendly toward these sorts of demonstrations.
Right. And so at that point, let's say the point of Skokie, it was very clear that winning freedom and winning back freedom, in order for that to happen, it's necessary that we uphold the First Amendment. But we need to be clear that in representing this group in Georgia, and I think we're moving to that case, it's strictly about government action. And what we believe and what the Constitution protects protects you and protects me and protects anybody else, is from government intervention in your speech.
I'm so happy to hear you to say that, Debbie, because the I'm reminded that Skokie was not just something that the political classes or the wonks paid attention to. It actually made its way into popular culture. I don't know if you remember that old movie from the early 1980s called The Blues Brothers.
Oh, absolutely.
And do you remember they had something that pretty clearly was based on this? They had a Nazi party demonstration in a park, and they had people yelling back at them. And it was, of course, done for comedic effect. And I'm not making light of this very serious issue. But it was funny how there was a great public outcry against these Nazis. And that's exactly what you're talking about. You know, nobody was shutting them up. They were letting them protest. And the remedy was the counter-protest.
Right. And we would protect the counter-protest, too.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I've been speaking to Debbie Seagraves, who directs the Georgia branch of the ACLU, all about the decision of the ACLU to represent the Ku Klux Klan in its quest to adopt a highway.
The KKK is trying to adopt a mile on Route 515. That's in Union County, Georgia. And if these white supremacists get there...
A local faction of the Ku Klux Klan has been denied their application to adopt a one-mile stretch of highway in northern Georgia, close to the North Carolina border.
But many are not proud to learn that the Ku Klux Klan wants a sign of its own, put up on Highway 515 at the Union County line. Like this one in Missouri, the Klan wants a sign showing it will take care of keeping a one-mile stretch of highway clean and beautiful.
I'm just going to cut right to the chase. Nothing like the Klan making the news, making local news, to remind you that you are back in the South.
And if these white supremacists get their way, they will need reflectors instead of hoods, because they'll be responsible for cleaning up litter on that stretch of the road.
Those against this are like, look, this is a hate group that is looking to pick up new membership and rebrand itself. And if the state goes along with this, the state is complicit.
I don't think there's anything I can do about it or anything I should do about it. I mean, it's free speech, free country.
Technically, if it were my choice, I would say no.
I just think it's wrong that the KKK can't even adopt the highway without people thinking they're trying to do something for attention or trying to do something for a bad or racist reason.
The American Civil Liberties Union is teaming up with the Ku Klux Klan, yes, the ACLU and the KKK. Earlier this month, Georgia denied the KKK's request to be part of the Adopt a Highway program, saying that promotes an organization with a history of inciting civil disturbance. Now the ACLU says it will help KKK.
Let's switch gears now for a moment and have our Madison Minute.
The marriage of James and Dolly Madison foreshadowed the modern political partnerships of presidents and first ladies by 200 years. After a brief courtship spanning the spring and summer, 26-year-old widow Dolly Payne Todd married 43-year-old Congressman James Madison on September 15, 1794. As Madison continued to rise in the political ranks, first as Thomas Jefferson's Secretary of State and then as two-term President of the United States, Dolly served as a dynamic political partner, national hostess, and first lady. The couple retired to Montpelier in 1817, where they managed a large plantation, entertained hundreds of visitors, and jointly edited Madison's significant political papers, including his notes on the Constitutional Convention. Madison predeceased Dolly by 13 years, after which he traveled back and forth between Montpelier and Washington, D.C., before permanently settling in the nation's capital in 1844. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
It's your weekly Constitutional, and we're cleaning up with the Klan in Georgia. After the break, we'll have our Constitutional quiz, and then we'll speak to a couple of lawyers who have associated themselves with the Georgia ACLU and who are representing the Klan in their lawsuit against the state. Don't touch that dial.
Stand up and be counted. Show the world that you're a man. Stand up and be counted. Go with the Ku Klux Klan. We are a sacred brotherhood who love our country too. We always can be counted on when there's a job to do. We serve our homeland day and night to keep it always free. And proudly wear our robes of white, protecting liberty. Stand up and be counted. Show the world that you're a man. Stand up and be counted. Go with the Ku Klux Klan.
Once again, it's time for our Constitutional quiz. I'm excited. I hope that you're excited, because I know that Kelly Carmichael is excited.
I'm always excited.
So am I, especially when it's time for our quiz. And also on the line is Maggie from Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. Maggie, are you excited?
I am excited.
Well, then that's just great. But don't get so excited that you mess up, because remember, it's a very high-stakes quiz, and only if you answer the question correctly will you earn the T-shirt that says Your Weekly Constitutional across the front. So, Kelly, take it away.
All right, Maggie. Question for you today. Congress created a law that imposed a fine on any person that had ever owned a foreign car, even prior to the law. That would be a violation of the Constitution because it is A, bill of attainder, B, an ex post facto law, C, a violation of habeas corpus, or D, a tariff.
Wow.
Okay, can you repeat the first one again?
I can repeat the question again. Yes, so Congress created a law that imposed a fine on any person that had ever owned a foreign car, even prior to the law. If this happened, this would be a violation of the Constitution because it is A, a bill of attainder, B, an ex post facto law, C, a violation of habeas corpus, or D, a tariff.
Now, while Maggie's thinking about those answer choices, I'll have to say that if we were to pass a law penalizing possession of foreign cars, even retroactively, those of us who are originally from Detroit would think that would be a fine law. A fine
right.
law.
I did live in Michigan for a bit of time. And
you've
that is
given me an idea.
Accurate.
I'm going to write my congressman, and that's what that will take care of those foreign car manufacturers. All right. So if we did a law like that, it would violate the Constitution, you say, for one of those four reasons. What are those four reasons again?
A, bill of attainder, B, ex post facto law, C, violation of habeas corpus, or D, a tariff.
Maggie? Give us your reasoning on this one. Why don't you go through the answers and tell us what you think?
Well, I'm pretty sure it's not habeas corpus, because that means produce the body. That's kind of irrelevant.
Okay, no body here to be produced. Okay.
No. And the first one was bill of retainer?
Bill of attainder.
Attainder. And I don't think that's right, because it just doesn't sound right. I think
that's
it's extra
good reasoning. Just doesn't sound right. Okay, absolutely.
I think the answer is B.
What is B again?
Ex post facto.
Ex
post facto law.
What does ex post facto mean?
I'm trying to remember, but something is making the bells go off in my head right now for that one.
Okay. Kelly? Is she on the right track?
She is. She earned her T-shirt today.
Yay! We have a winner. Maggie, congratulations.
Yay. Thank you.
Ex post facto means very much what all those Latin scholars out there think it means. It means after the fact, making something illegal after the fact and penalizing people for something that was legal when they did it, but no longer is legal. And that's a favorite technique of tyrants. And our founders did not want that, did they?
This is true. And you know, going back to that example, if Congress were able to pass a law or ever would pass a law penalizing those who own a foreign car, it would be that law would only take effect for those moving forward, not in, you know, retrospective those who already own a currently own a foreign car. But
I
am convinced that this will never happen.
Yeah, and in fact, an interesting follow-up question would be whether such a law, even if only prospective, would be constitutional. But I'm not going to put that question to you right now.
So, but that's a good conversation for some of your law students.
Yeah, it would be very, and we may very well discuss that in the future. But for the moment, Maggie, you've done everything you needed to do. You have won the quiz, and so we will be getting a T-shirt to you in the very near future.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for playing.
Congrats, Maggie. Thanks.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're cleaning up with the Klan, or at least we're talking to a couple of lawyers from Atlanta who are helping the Ku Klux Klan to adopt a highway, or that is to protest and to object to the state of Georgia's refusal to allow the Klan to adopt a highway. It's a fascinating constitutional issue. Doesn't the Klan have the same free speech rights as the rest of us, or do they? Let's talk to Alan and Corey Begner.
I'm Alan Begner. My wife, Corey, is my law partner. We are First Amendment litigators. By trade. I like to think that we show governments how overreaching is not a good idea.
I see. Anything to add to that, Corey?
No, Alan mostly does the interviews, but so I'll just jump in if I want to add anything.
Tremendous. Well, the reason we're here today, of course, is because we're doing an episode on the Ku Klux Klan here in Georgia that wants to apparently adopt a highway. So tell us about this case, if you would.
Well, you know, I think many states have the Adopt a Highway program, or an offshoot of it is probably one of the best government programs that exists to get citizens to clean up a mile marker worth of highway and have a sign identifying it as belonging to them for that purpose. The Ku Klux Klan International Keystone Knights, who we represent, are a Georgia chapter of the Arkansas Ku Klux Klan that David Duke led when he ran for president years ago.
National Association for the Advancement of White People. I remember David Duke, yes.
And they live up near Union County and went first to the Union County officials to adopt a highway. That the program had been delegated to the county at the time, and they were accepted. They were given vests, they were given trash bags, and said they would order the sign that would say International Keystone Knights of the Ku Klux Klan that they could put up on a poll marker shortly thereafter. Well,
now, Alan, I have to interrupt you at this point. I have to, because, and I realize it's a serious issue. I don't mean to make light of it, but I'm getting a really comedic visual image. I'm seeing a bunch of guys in white bed sheets and pointy white hats with red vests on, picking up trash and waving at passersby. Is that what we're talking about here?
See, this is exactly what the government sees, which is like, it's probably dangerous to allow them to clean up trash in their white robes and coned hats, so we ought to deny it for that reason, among others.
Uh-huh. But that's not what they're talking about doing, I'm guessing.
That's right. That's not what they're talking about doing. And so the day after they're accepted up in Union County in Northwest Georgia, or North Georgia, they got a letter saying that the whole program was being discontinued.
The whole program? Mm-hmm.
Or at least what was called the offshoot program, Keep Our Mountains Beautiful, that had been delegated from Adopt a Highway. And we're told to apply downtown Atlanta with the Georgia Department of Transportation for the main Adopt a Highway program, which they did. Well, over the next week or two, nobody could think of a reason to deny them that made sense, so they just didn't give them an answer. And finally, the governor himself decided the question by issuing emails to the department to say, deny them. And
so the governor himself got involved in
this? He did.
Now, that's rather unusual for the governor to reach down and make decisions on the Adopt a Highway program.
That's right.
I'm guessing, right?
It is unusual.
Okay.
So on the radio, I hear about this happening, and I hear that the reason they're denying them is because they are a hate group, and their message is hateful, which, of course, triggers bells in my head, which is the thing a government cannot do and get away with is to deny an application based on the content of the speech. This is classically unconstitutional, and it perked my ears up.
Oh, I guess it does. Before we get to the constitutional issues, though, let's acknowledge. I mean, the KKK, if anybody's a hateful group, they're probably a fairly hateful group of people. I mean, rather like the Nazi Party or a lot of other groups that have done some fairly nasty thing and espouse some pretty nasty ideologies. So, okay, we acknowledge reality. We acknowledge the rather absurd image that I brought up a moment ago of these guys on the side of the highway. So you can see why this would give people pause. But then, as you say, these are government officials, and they are going to make a judgment that this group, which is before them, is somehow beyond the pale, and so the government is now going to act to do what? To deny them?
Right, to censor speech. This is, of course, another bell that goes off in your head when the government is the censor. And so, it perked up my thoughts on the case. And shortly thereafter, both...
What are the point of fact?
Yeah.
I'm going to take a wild guess that you're not a member of the KKK.
Well, it's correct. I'm not a member of the KKK.
Okay, all right.
Of course, I'm a Jewish lawyer. And so...
Okay, so definitely not a member of the KKK. All right.
Well, I could be, but I'm not.
Okay.
So anyway, shortly thereafter, both the ACLU, who was interested in the case, and the Klan directly called and approached us about representing them in the challenge. And Corey and I talked about it, and I'm just a defender of pure speech, and so it was easy for me to decide this was an issue, a narrow issue, to take up. Corey agreed to do it also, and so and the firm agreed, and so we went ahead and just did it for the ACLU. We agreed to be lead counsel in an ACLU challenge. Yes.
Well, I would like to point out that in becoming a member of the Adopt a Highway program, the Klan was not in a position to espouse its political beliefs or its racial beliefs. They merely wanted to have a sign put up on the highway with their name on it and perform the community service of cleanup.
Exactly.
Right, so it simply would have been a sign that said what you said, you know, identify their organization. So we're not talking about cross-burning ceremonies on the median.
Just clean up litter.
Okay. All right.
So we decided to accept the invitation of the ACLU and began filing open records requests to see what exactly had happened and waited until we could get back the emails, the rules about when you can grant and deny these applications.
That's a very powerful tool, a very powerful tool. Let me ask you about that. This is under Georgia's open records law, I'm guessing?
Yes.
Okay. Did you have any difficulty getting these records?
No, I think they complied in a serious fashion. There were emails that we received in which lawyers for the state were ordering other people to comply in a serious fashion. And as far as I know, they did comply.
Well, I'm glad to hear that because, you know, so often the Freedom of Information Act on the federal level or the state analogs are extraordinarily powerful tools.
Yes.
And the government officials are known to resist them or at least to drag their feet. And so good for Georgia for not doing that in this case.
And on the other hand, there aren't any smoking gun memos that if they got out would be so scandalous that it would mean a career, so it wasn't hard for that reason.
And also, Georgia takes their Open Records Act pretty seriously. In fact, last session, the legislature strengthened the Open Records Act and instituted civil penalties and criminal penalties more severe than had previously been in effect. And I have to say that our Sam Olens, our Attorney General, was responsible for getting that act strengthened.
Well, good for the AG. Okay, so you've got your records. You know what's going on now, or at least you know as much as the records tell you. And what did they tell you?
Well, they told us that there are no regulations that would inform a denier of the license, the Georgia Department of Transportation officially, as to what guidelines they may use to do it. It says that, for instance, the program is open to good citizens,
civic-minded
organizations, which I think the Klan is, nor do they define what a civic-minded...
Well, that's an interesting thing, because almost anybody who's willing to volunteer to pick up trash is almost by definition civic-minded.
I'm going to quote you when we get into Discovery. You're right.
Hey, I'm not part of this. I'm trying to be objective. I'm just trying to understand your arguments. Okay.
But, for instance, if you're denied, there's no grounds for denial or There is no appeal provisions. And so these all, of course, violate other kinds of constitutional procedural due process matters, which are constitutional but not First Amendment mm-hmm. challenges. And so, I mean, other than that, one of the interesting things we got from the Open Records Act is a copy of a famous Missouri ruling from a U.S. District Court and a Court of Appeals in some years ago on almost identical facts that found that the Adopt a Highway program request by the Ku Klux Klan there violated the First Amendment.
So
they had the case in their files and really knew they couldn't do it.
Well, that explains... yeah, absolutely. Okay, so you got a case out of Georgia in federal court... Excuse me, out of Missouri. Identical facts, virtually.
Yes.
So it's what we lawyers like to say, on point.
Yes.
And not doesn't control you necessarily because it's out of a different state.
Yes.
But it's certainly what we call very, very highly persuasive right. authority.
Yes. And there... the authorities simply wouldn't process the application and spent years without ever getting to the denial phase. It was like we're still thinking about it. But
thinking really hard.
Right. But yes, so... but we did one thing that's different than what most lawyers would do, and that is we did not file this in U.S. District Court, but in the state court system, what was the Superior Court of Fulton County. Mm-hmm. And... we did that for an important reason. The Georgia Constitution is famous for giving its citizens greater constitutional rights than the U.S. Constitution, and says so quite often, and says so with a lot of happiness that they're able to. And so we filed it only under the Georgia Constitution.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm having a fascinating discussion with Alan and Corey Begner, two lawyers associated with the ACLU in Georgia, who are fighting for the right, the free speech rights, the constitutional rights of the Ku Klux Klan to adopt a highway. After the break, we'll find out what's happening this week at Montpelier, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Alan and Corey Begner. Stay tuned.
Zieht deine Bahn überm Reich des Ku Klux Klan und der Mond zieht deine Bahn überm Reich des Ku Klux Klan durch die Fluten des Mississippi fährt ein Dampfer langsam vorbei.
Kelly Carmichael, what's happening this week at Montpelier?
Well, we have our third seminar, our weekend seminar for the academic year.
This is for teachers, for educators.
Educators to come and join us and immerse themselves into the study of the Constitution. And this one, I think, is really interesting, especially for our civics and government teachers, because we'll be focusing on the structure of the Constitution and separation of powers and checks and balances, which are such important concepts that, as you know, civics and government teachers need to teach to their students.
Indeed they do, and that is extremely important concept, and lots of people will be interested in it. Now, we've talked about these seminars before. You say this is the third in the series, right?
Third for the fall, and then we'll take a break and we'll be back in March doing our weekend seminars. But yeah, this last one for the fall will be on November 30th, which is a Friday, and ends on Sunday, December 2nd.
And teachers can come here for free. They can stay in the Constitutional Village for free. It's a free intellectual break. It's like a really high-quality retreat.
It is a great high-quality retreat and gives our educators some really good content on the Constitution.
Absolutely. Well, I encourage every teacher who has not come so far, or even if you have come already,
come back
again. Exactly right. And how do they do that?
Go to learn.montpelier.org, and you can apply directly online for this particular seminar, or we have our spring seminars online as well.
Oh, okay, so they can plan ahead. So learn.montpelier.org, and there's no charge for teachers and just a small tuition charge for the members of the general public.
General public, if this sounds interesting, please come and join. We normally have some general public who just joins into these seminars, and they're really great experience for everybody to continue to enhance your knowledge of the Constitution in a really nonpartisan setting.
Tremendous. Well, thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Alan and Corey Begner, two lawyers in Atlanta who work with the ACLU. And right now, they're helping the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan, in the Klan's quest to adopt a highway in Georgia. Alan was just telling me that they did not proceed as I thought they would under Section 1983 of the United States Code. They're not proceeding under the U.S. Constitution. They've decided to proceed pursuant to the Georgia Constitution. Let's let Alan tell us why.
I expected you to tell me a couple of things. I expect you to tell me that this was under the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, specifically the Free Speech Clause. Mm-hmm. I expected you to tell me you had filed something called a 1983 action, which is the federal statute that allows people like you to file these lawsuits to vindicate constitutional rights, and that even allows you to get your fees and treble damages if you prove the violation of a well-established constitutional right. So I thought I knew where you're going procedurally with this, but you're telling me something very different, right. And you're bringing up a very important constitutional issue. That is that we've got 51 constitutions in this country. Every state has one, and that sometimes those state constitutions grant greater rights and greater protections to individuals. And that is just remarkable. So Georgia's one of those.
Indeed.
Okay.
Georgia, for instance, is the first state to have recognized the right of privacy in the country in 1904 in a case called Pavisich versus New England Life, and is very proud of that. And this is not technically a right of privacy case, but the notions of the right of people and privacy law are very closely intertwined.
And I'd like to also say that we did not feel it necessary to proceed under the federal statute, as you refer to it, the 1983 statute, because our client agreed not to seek damages from the state.
Oh, okay.
But our client's aim is to get the permit.
Right. So you're just asking for the permit. There's no money question here.
Right.
But I do have to ask the lawyer question, though, because I know you're not doing this for the money. On the other hand, is there a fee-shifting provision in the Georgia statute that allows this? I mean, is there any chance?
No, we don't expect to get attorney's fees, and we're not being paid to do it either.
Okay, so there's just no way you're ever going to get any money out of this case.
Right. But okay.
Well, were you
right.
Some sort of crazy guy? What are you doing all this work for free? With no hope of recovery.
I don't know how crazy I am. I just want to win the issue. And there's there's one other reason why we decided to file it in the state system, and that is the state court judges are less antagonistic in our county where we filed it than the U.S. District Court judges to the First Amendment.
Hmm.
And the Supreme Court of Georgia, while definitely not liberal, is also less antagonistic to First Amendment rights than the 11th Circuit, which is one of the most difficult federal circuits of all to get to uphold First Amendment rights.
And also, I like to say that we have been offered and have been getting extensive help from the ACLU, which, even though it's a small office, does have over 20 student law clerks that they have made available to
us. That's nice.
To do research.
Now, we're in Atlanta, so where do those clerks come from? I guess it's probably not mostly UGA, is it? It's probably mostly the...
Well, I'm sure it's spread around. We have, we have Emory Law School, John Marshall Law School,
right.
Georgia State.
And Georgia State.
Several fine law schools.
Plus
right
Georgia
here in
and Athens, right?
Yeah, and that's not that far. Athens isn't that far away.
It's not.
Okay, so, well, this is all interesting stuff. Now, I realize we haven't quite gotten to the constitutional issues yet, but I think this is very, very interesting because it shows all of the various considerations that lawyers like yourselves have to go through when they're planning out their litigation strategy. So I think this is very instructive and very interesting even for non-lawyers. Okay, so you filed your lawsuit in Georgia for all of those reasons, and what happens next?
Well, there are a number of defendants, including a number of individuals, And they'll have to file answers, which are due in a couple weeks, perhaps. And then there are 6 months set aside automatically for discovery, for depositions, for interrogatories, to try to tie down what is the reason they have denied it and whether or not they've denied anyone before, and so forth. And then we don't expect the case to take much longer after that if we can get heard. That is, the causes of action we've sued for, one is called mandamus, which is a common law cause of action that is known throughout the country, but it simply says make the government do what they're required by law to do, which in this case is issue the permits for the Adopt-a-Highway program. We seek injunction to prohibit them from denying us. We seek declaratory judgment in which we challenge a number of both the provisions for processing applications as unconstitutional in violation of due process and overbroad, which is a First Amendment cause of action.
The due process stuff is, right. In the simplest terms, it's a general requirement that people be treated fairly and above board, and you're simply saying the fact that there are no standards here means that how can we know if they're being treated properly or not?
And even to take it one step farther, there generally must be ascertainable standards by which applicants can predict in advance whether they meet the requirements or not.
Right, and if there's no standard, then how can you even know?
And so the effect of having no standards and having no appeal procedure, regardless perhaps of whether or not a court were to find it violated the First Amendment, the main challenge, could rule for us for independent reasons.
Yeah, in fact, the general rule in these sorts of cases, which come under the broad heading of, even though it seems somewhat incongruous, in this circumstance, there's something called prior restraint, is that you have very, very clear standards and almost no discretion in the government official, because effectively what the Klan is seeking here is a license from the state to put this sign up, and that's their speech. And whenever the state has to grant a license before speech is allowed, we call that prior restraint, and it's subject to extremely strict requirements, and so that's what essentially you're arguing here.
Yeah, both as to time limits for ruling and as to written standards that are required to be used to deny.
Okay, so that's both First Amendment and due process. But let's get right to the ultimate issue. The ultimate issue, of course, is simply free speech under the First Amendment.
Yes.
So run us through the arguments you're making and the arguments that you think they're going to be making in response or what they've made this point.
Well, as long as the matter is clearly speech, I think there's no question about that. The right to put a sign on a sign pole and get a permit is clearly speech, and so it cannot be denied in an arbitrary way. It cannot be denied based upon the message of the speech.
That's right, called a content-based restriction,
and triggers, as you know, strict scrutiny.
Could you run through what that is? Strict scrutiny.
When a law is content-based, then the burden on the government to uphold the denial and the law is very heavy. Strict scrutiny means that
strict scrutiny requires a compelling government interest that is as narrowly tailored as possible to prevent the speech, and it must be the courts will almost never, when applying strict scrutiny, uphold a restriction on content-based speech.
Yep, that is extremely important, so we'll restate it one more time. The government has the complete burden of showing, one, that it has a compelling interest. That's not just any interest, but that's something that's really, really important, like national security or public safety. And then secondly, it has to show essentially that this is the only way to achieve that interest.
The least restrictive way.
Yeah, the least restrictive way or necessary. They use right. several different terms to describe that. And as you just said, Corey, the government almost never wins.
As a matter of fact, I believe that the only time they have won in a case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court was Korematsu, the famous World War II era case when Japanese Americans were rounded up and put in concentration light camps in the middle of the country. That act was upheld by the Supreme Court. I'm not aware of any other case where a strict scrutiny burden was overcome by the government. So
it's awfully, awfully rare.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the government's burden when it wants to regulate the content of speech. And so, do you think that's the way the court will look at this case?
I think they will.
Mm-hmm.
It's having had them announce early on that it was a hate-filled message that was the reason for them to deny it means that if they come up with another reason, and they have several others, then there's that. But,
and do you have the denial letter itself in front of you?
The one from DOT?
Yes.
Yes.
That's it. What are the reasons that the DOT gives?
Let's see. The department has determined for the safety of any volunteers and the traveling public that this location is not an area which may be adopted. The impact of erecting a sign naming an organization which has a long-rooted history of civil disturbance would cause a significant public concern. Impacts include safety of the traveling public, potential social unrest, driver distraction, or interference with the flow of traffic. These potential impacts are such that were the application granted, the goal of the program to allow civic-minded organizations to participate in public service for the state would not be met.
Okay. Now I can see, but people can't see this because this is radio, but Corey is smiling here whenever you mention the word public safety. But let me play devil's advocate. Of course, we've invited the governor's office, the state of Georgia, to talk to us as well. Thus far, they've not said that they would. So assuming for the moment that they can't speak for themselves, let me say that I'm the Attorney General of the state of Georgia. And I would walk in and I would say, Your Honor, we definitely meet strict scrutiny, and here's why. We have a compelling interest in public safety. There are children in minivans going up and down that highway, and we've got to protect them. And in fact, that's definitely within what we call the police power of the state of Georgia to protect those people. So there's your compelling interest, Judge. And secondly, the only way to achieve that safety is to prevent this wretched, horrible hate organization from putting up a sign, because we know some driver is going to go down there and is going to see that sign and it's going to be distracted by it and it's going to gasp and is going to jerk his steering wheel and run into somebody else, and we're going to have deaths on the highway, Judge. So the only way to prevent that from happening is to prevent these horrible, hate-filled people from having that speech on the highway. That's the argument. Now, how do you respond to that?
Well, at least they have no argument that the workers who might be picking up litter are somehow dangerous, since they're not going to be in white robes and white cone hats.
Well, I haven't even gotten to that yet.
You were
saving that
for
me. I'm just talking the sign that's going to be there, you know, year round.
I think that argument is frivolous.
Well, there's, okay. You know, any right. organization uh-huh. that puts up a sign or has a sign put up by the state for an Adopt a Highway program, there's no guarantee that 100% of the people are going to know and love that organization. There's no evidence that the government can use to show that just the existence of a sign with the name of that particular organization is more dangerous, is less safe than any other organization's name on a sign. I mean, there might be a sign from a Boy Scout troop. I might have very negative feelings toward the Boy Scouts. Mm-hmm. Someone else might have very negative feelings towards some other organization.
Mitt Romney for president could cause a lot of potential trouble.
Okay, well, again, just to put this in context then, you would probably agree that traffic safety is a compelling interest. I mean, safety is always a compelling interest.
Yes.
In fact, that's the easy part of the constitutional argument. But the second prong of the test of the strict scrutiny is where you're taking issue. And that's because, as Corey was just saying, let me paraphrase it if I may, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but there's no evidence that simply having a sign up there that probably most people don't read is going to create a traffic safety issue. We have all sorts of signs up all the time that somebody somewhere is going to find offensive. And that, therefore, is not necessarily going to cause any increase in traffic deaths. Is that fair?
That's fair.
Okay. Well,
That's fair.
Okay. Well, I mean, I didn't mean to make your argument for you. I just want to make sure I understand that. So, okay, that's where it is. And so that's why you think it's frivolous, because I might get angry at a Boy Scout sign.
Well, and you also, as you stated, where's the evidence to support the hypothesis?
Mm-hmm.
That you can't just simply say, I think it's going to cause traffic problems. What is the evidence it has?
I see. Well, that'll be interesting. Well, surely the state of Georgia and its Department of Transportation must realize that there are lots and lots of distracting signs out there. In fact, one of my pet peeves is these brand new signs that are out there so brightly lit and that, you know, that flash all the time. They've distracted me a couple of times.
Right, especially if there's a attractive woman moving in the sign.
I'll tell you a story. I'll tell you a story. Years ago in Detroit, my hometown, on the highway, I-94 leading from the highway, there was this huge billboard, and on it was that old copper tone ad, and it would showed a very shapely young woman wearing a bikini, and then it was an ad for copper tone. Well, a couple of rogues, probably teenage boys, went out one Sunday night and painted over the bikini in flesh tones. And the next day, apparently, the entire highway was tied in knots because drivers were confronted with a 50-foot-long naked woman reclining next to the highway. So I guess distracting signs do exist.
And this sign is small, though. It must be something like 12 inches by 9 inches or something.
Right. So that's, again, it's a matter of there are lots of distracting signs out there. Why are you singling out this one? So that brings the next question. Why do you think that the governor's office, or the governor himself apparently, is making this decision?
Well, that's the easy one to answer.
Uh-huh.
This is the same answer for politicians throughout the country, and that is if a politician can say that he is against an unpopular application, then it helps him politically, and he is very much willing to refuse to do it, require that the applicant sue, make the judge look like a bad guy or a bad woman, and then blame the judge. And that's exactly what has happened here and happens throughout the country.
And that's our show, Cleaning Up with a Klan. I'd like to thank very much Debbie Seagraves of the Georgia ACLU and also Alan and Corey Begner, the associated attorneys who are representing the Klan in its attempt to adopt a highway. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Larry Mayer. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.